I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. This weekend's mass shooting in Kansas City, Kansas, leaves us asking again, what can we do about gun violence in this country? The NPR collaborative Guns in America recently released the results of its national survey gathering people's views on gun issues and what they know about gun deaths. Today we'll go through some of the surprising findings. Then musician John McEwen is back. The co-founder of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band is touring for his latest album in the wake of being featured in Ken Burns' documentary Country Music. We'll ask what the experience was like and if he's gained any new fans. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. America continues to wrestle with what to do about its guns. How much gun control will citizens accept in the wake of a spate of mass shootings, including the one this weekend in KCK? NPR's Guns in America reporting team has been covering this incredibly controversial topic, along with results of a new national survey that examined Americans' knowledge of the causes of gun deaths and their support for the safe storage of guns. They're also reporting on how the Democratic presidential candidates are approaching this issue and how far they're willing to go on gun control. With us now are two reporters from NPR's Guns in America team. They are Heath Druzan, is from Boise State Public Radio. Heath, good morning.
Morning.
Lisa Dunn is the Guns in America research editor from WAMU out in Washington, D.C. Lisa, nice to have you too.
Thanks so much. Good to be here.
Well, let's dive right into the results of this national survey that Guns in America just released. This was a poll that your group did with APM Research Lab that asked Americans about their views of various gun issues. You asked about Americans' knowledge of gun death causes. Heath, I'm wondering, what did you find?
Well, we found that they don't know much, to be honest. They greatly exaggerated the effect of homicides and mass shootings, which are obviously also homicides, but that was a separate category, and very much undervalued how many gun deaths are actually suicides. And to be clear, suicide is by far the leading cause of gun deaths in the U.S.
And you're saying that that point is lost on a lot of people, right, Heath?
That's correct. That's correct. Only 23% actually correctly identified suicide as the leading cause of gun deaths in the U.S. Homicides were the plurality at 33%. And then came mass shootings, and then a fairly large number also thought accidental shootings were the leading cause of death. So it was pretty much across the board, just a major misperceptions about what drives gun violence or gun deaths in the U.S.
When in fact, again, to reiterate here, it's suicide that leads the pack here, if I have you understand you correctly, Heath.
That's correct. 60% of all gun deaths in the U.S. Are suicides.
You know, Lisa, what's the significance of this finding? You know, that only, what, a quarter of Americans surveyed know that suicides are the primary source of gun deaths in this country. Why does that matter?
Well, I think it matters because it turns out that what we know from research about suicide is that there's a great deal of impulsivity in those attempts, and that what we know is that something on the order of 9 in 10 individuals who attempt suicide actually don't go on to attempt again. So I think when we look at these survey results and we're looking for sort of what does it mean, and I think what we see is an area of the gun topic that appears to be ripe for possibly some agreement, some across the bridge, bridging of divides there. It turns out that we do have some solid research about guns and what ends up happening with suicides. And so I think that can be somewhat encouraging.
So the fact that suicides leads the pack here, that might have policy implications going forward, Lisa, if I hear you right?
Yes, I think so. Yes, and I think that we found in the other two aspects of the poll similar implications with respect to suicide and guns, and we can talk about that as well.
Well, I was going to say, let's turn to another set of findings here about let's talk about the safe storage of guns. Heath, how about the use of gun locks? What did you find there in your survey?
I apologize, but I think Lisa's actually in a better
position. Lisa, go with that. That's fine. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. I'll jump in. Right. So what we found is we asked people, first of all, if they owned a gun, what did they do with the gun when they weren't using it? Did they store it in a locked container or what did they do? And when we also asked them about, do they think that guns should be mandated to be locked up in a container and while they're not being used? And what we found was essentially widespread support for a law mandating that guns are stored with a lock in place. And essentially about 8 in 10 of Americans that we surveyed registered support for that kind of law. Only about 2 in 10 were opposed. And we also found that this cut across all demographics with
partisan lines too, you're saying here, Lisa.
As well as partisan lines, right. Republicans, something on the order of 7 out of 10 Republicans supported the idea of this kind of a law. And women were slightly more supportive than men. But another key factor is that well over 60% of gun owners also supported the idea of mandating that guns be stored with a lock in place. And then we also asked gun owners, okay, when you're not using your gun, how often do you lock it up? We found that about just under 60% of gun owners said that they did indeed lock up their guns, but as many as 4 in 10 actually did not. So that's also a significant number.
And you wonder if that number in reality isn't higher, because when you ask on a survey, hey, do you lock up your gun? Most people are going to be inclined to say, oh, yes, I'm responsible. I do the right thing, right?
Steve, I think that's right. Other surveys that have asked people about their storage habits have found around 50%. So around in line with our findings, but I agree. Yeah, I think it would tend to be more, they would want to report safe storage more than not.
Any sense, Heath, if states have laws requiring use of gun locks, is there a need for more laws in that area?
Well, I think there we need to do a lot more research because there are states with these laws, but obviously there's different issues, right? There's the issue of that Lisa brought up of suicides that are impulsive suicides, and maybe that's a way to keep a teenager in distress from getting access to the guns. And then there's also the issue of accidents and children getting access. And there's a lot of nuance there, too, and how exactly you're storing your gun. So I think, like a lot of things in the area of guns, there a lot more research needs to be done, because we've had a real dearth of research across the spectrum for the last 20 years.
Okay, these findings come after you guys released a survey on a related topic, and that's red flag laws. These are, gun control laws that permit police or family members to petition a court, maybe to order the temporary confiscation of firearms from a person who might be posing a danger to others or even to themselves. Lisa, what did that survey find? Just remind us, because we talked about it a few weeks ago.
Sure. Similar findings as our safe storage polling, in that wide, broad support for the idea of these so-called red flag laws or extreme risk protection orders, where it allows a family member or law enforcement to petition a court for a temporary removal of firearms for someone who is a risky individual, posing some kind of a risk either to himself or to others. And we did find widespread support among all demographics and also among Republicans as well. About 77% of Americans that we surveyed supported this idea of a red flag law. And, you know, this again, like the safe storage, we're seeing a category of gun issues that seems to get widespread support even among gun owners. So I think the findings were significant.
And to be clear, Lisa, some states have already enacted red flag laws, right?
Yes, that's right. About 17 states and the District of Columbia have some kind of a red flag law or an extreme risk protection order. Missouri is currently not one of them, as you know, Steve. Mm-hmm. I think there have been at least one proposed, but so far no law exists in Missouri.
Or Kansas, I think, for that matter.
Or Kansas, that's right. Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. So at least in this case, Heath, you get a sense there's room to run here with bipartisan support, at least in a couple of categories of gun control measures, if I'm hearing you two correctly.
Well, you know, that's what's really interesting about red flag laws, certainly. I mean, broad support. There's broad support for universal background checks. What's interesting about a lot of these issues is that poll after poll seems to find that Americans actually broadly support some additional steps. And it's very sort of out of line with just how gridlocked it seems to be in Congress.
Any sense from, let's just cut to the nut here, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, get a sense, is he willing to look at some of these things, or is the answer no?
I mean, I think, okay. Oh, go ahead, Lisa.
Oh, no, I was going to say that I think the sense that we got from the majority leader was that he was waiting for some kind of a signal from President Trump before moving forward on any kind of gun legislation.
President Trump sort of been all over the room on this issue, if I recall correctly.
That's right. He has. On the issue of red flag laws, there has been some kind of murmurings of law being drafted by Senator Lindsey Graham from South Carolina and Richard Blumenthal in Connecticut, that they were sort of said to be working on some kind of a bipartisan red flag law. We haven't seen anything yet coming there. But, you know, it's I imagine, given that the level of support that we found in the poll we worked on, that that's an issue that possibly could be taken up in the Senate.
And that would obviously make a red flag laws the law of the land for every state in the country then, right?
Well, I think my understanding is that it would act as more of an incentive program so that it would actually allow the states to apply for grants. So states that would pass a red flag law would be eligible for a federal grant that would give them support in terms of implementation, in terms of training, in terms of, you know, extra law enforcement help and that sort of thing.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking this morning about a new survey that NPR's Guns in America reporting team has conducted about gun laws and what citizens might find acceptable and unacceptable. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. You know, I can't help but wonder, Heath, about how much misinformation is out there when it comes to guns. This is such a white hot topic for so many Americans. You know, people think Congress has done nothing on this issue, but in fact, it's moved on bump stocks, which allow gun owners to turn a semi-automatic rifle into a weapon that fires continuously. Is there a lot of misunderstanding out there?
I would say yes and no. There is a lot of misunderstanding, and I think the poll that we talked about initially shows that people just don't really understand, what's causing gun deaths, for example. And I think, you know, most people don't own guns. And I think there's also probably a lot of misunderstanding about what guns are. People constantly call AR-15s machine guns, which mm-hmm. they are not. That's one example. And I know that drives certainly proponents of gun rights pretty crazy. But as far as Congress doing nothing, I think maybe people have a point on that. You're absolutely right about bump stocks. Those were banned, and not even grandfathered in. So even if you owned a bump stock before the ban, you had to either destroy it or turn it in. So that was pretty aggressive, but it also really covered kind of a niche, almost novelty product, even though it was used to unfortunately, you know, great tragic effect in Las Vegas in that Harvest Festival mass shooting. So, yeah, I do think there is a point there for Congress really not having done a lot for, you know, over a decade, really.
Lisa, what have we learned about the different types of policies that are out there and how some policies are more effective than others at combating different types of gun violence?
Right. I think the answer is that the problem of gun violence is so multifaceted, right? So there are so many different aspects of it that it's important when policymakers set out to try to come up with a solution that they're actually targeting the right aspect. And as Heath so correctly mentioned, we do know that 60% of gun deaths in the U.S. are suicides. So we have a great deal of research that does support a link between some of these ideas, certain policy ideas like safe storage, like red flag laws. We know that there's evidence that shows that when those laws are in place, that the numbers of suicides, particularly among young people, actually decline significantly. In Connecticut and Indiana, for example, those two states have had red flag laws on the books for more than 10 years. Hmm. And a couple of different studies have found that in those states, they experience upwards of 15% fewer suicides as a result of those laws. So I think we do know a great deal with respect to some aspects of the sort of huge big picture of gun violence in the U.S.
Let's go to some phone calls at 816-235-2888. Richard from Kansas City, Kansas. Richard, you're on with our Guns in America team. Good morning.
Hi. You know, this latest shooting, the guy had a record. He should never have had a gun.
In Kansas City, Kansas, you're talking about, right?
Yeah. But here's the thing. We have the technology, and there is no excuse for us not to manufacture every single gun in America that has palm print or fingerprint technology, rendering the weapon useless to anyone except the owner. And on top of which, what would that mean on the battlefield when the other army gets a hold of your weapon and is useless to them?
Hmm. Let me ask our guests, what do we know about that kind of technology, Heath?
Well, that's an interesting point. So that's smart gun technology, as it's known. And there's been a growing call to have some kind of rule about manufacturing where you would have a so-called smart gun where only the owner could access it. That's also something that's obviously a potentially heavy lift for the industry to change how they make guns. And there's been a lot of pushback from groups like the NRA. So it's yet to be seen, although certainly I've heard some Democratic candidates, when they've talked about guns, start to bring up that as something that they would like to see mandated in some way.
Let's talk about the Democratic candidates for a minute, because Heath, you covered a Democratic presidential forum last week in Las Vegas that examined gun policy. One thing you pointed out is that it's been difficult to stand out in a crowded field that largely agrees on gun issues. Was that still your view after this latest forum?
I think they do still largely agree, but certainly they were trying to separate themselves from the field, and I do wonder if former Congressman Beto O'Rourke's hell yes, we're going to take your AR moment, which kind of ricocheted across the country.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if that actually pushed candidates to the left in the end, because at this Las Vegas forum, certainly there were candidates who were trying to show that they were willing to go farther. And even a couple that mentioned mandatory buybacks, which essentially means you would take a person's semi-automatic rifle, military-style rifle, and compensate them for them, but there wouldn't be a choice. And that's something that candidates have been very hesitant to do in the past. So Yeah, I did notice that some candidates were talking more aggressively.
Candidates also talked about white nationalism. What did they say about that?
Yeah, that was something that seemed to be a bigger issue now for the candidates. They were saying that it's an existential threat, just like foreign terrorism. They were kind of putting it up at that level and saying this is something that we need to take seriously and that we need to stop, and that it, you know, they were tying that into to gun crime and to, you know, to hate crimes, basically.
What about gun buyback programs? You mentioned that here. Some disagreements on that issue. Is that fair to say, Heath?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Mm-hmm. There is disagreement on the issue. So a buyback program is what it sounds like. You could have a voluntary buyback program where the government says, we would like you to voluntarily turn in your weapon. And usually when they're talking about these weapons, they're talking about AR-15s, AK-47s, the kind of military-style semi-automatic rifle that's grabbed a lot of headlines. And then the other buyback program would be a mandatory buyback program, meaning you have to turn your gun in, although you will be compensated. And the example that comes up a lot with this is Australia. They had a mass shooting, I believe, in mm-hmm. the 90s, and they had a national buyback program. And where they went all around the country, obviously a much smaller country population-wise than us, but they did a national buyback.
Yeah. Let's go to some phone calls here. Marie from Leawood. Marie, you're on Up to Date. You there, Marie? Let's go to Chuck from Kansas City, Missouri. Chuck, you're on the air.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I wanted to make a comment about the Jonathan Metzl book, Die mm-hmm. of Whiteness, which I think you had on
right
air a couple of weeks ago, and this idea in the state of Missouri where just the proliferation of guns and people wanting to, you know, I want to own a gun, but their level of security at home is actually statistically less because, you know, if they die by an accidental shooting mm-hmm. or they decide to suicide by gun, there's no going back. It's not like taking pills and you can, you know, call 911 and get help if you shot yourself.
Mm-hmm. So your point is people are less safe with guns in their homes is what you're saying.
When you have that many, when it's just ubiquitous
mm-hmm.
And people are fighting so hard to keep their Second Amendment right because they want to be safe, but in the end, they're statistically not as safe if they didn't have the gun.
Heath, is there some truth to that?
I would like
Lisa?
To jump in.
Yeah, please.
Yeah, please.
Absolutely support what the caller's saying. There's a lot of research that supports exactly what he's saying, which is that having a gun in the home, it significantly increases your risk of mostly of suicide, but also of an accidental death as well. And it's unclear whether it increases your risk for homicide, but certainly with respect to domestic violence, we know that women living in a home with a gun with a domestic abuser are about five times as likely to be killed by that gun. So the caller is exactly right. Unfortunately, what happens is guns are often purchased for protection or an idea of self-defense when in fact they end up actually being used for largely other purposes.
Just a final point, Lisa. The NRA has been going through some turmoil of late. Has the power of that organization been diminished by all this controversy?
It's a really good question. I think, you know, I'm not, yeah, you know, we haven't specifically reported on the NRA mm-hmm. kind of nationally. But what I would say is that we do know that gun rights supporters in general tend to be very energized about their beliefs. And so the kind of the status of the larger NRA group, it's it's unclear whether that will actually have a significant effect on the folks who really feel strongly about Second Amendment rights, and whether it will affect, you know, what they actually decide to vote on when it comes to elections. We do know that as a group, they tend to be highly motivated. And so it's unclear at this point whether those national kind of scandals will have a significant impact.
One more call here from Joe from Kansas City, Missouri. Joe, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm just wondering, hear a lot of talk about the actual guns themselves, but I don't ever hear anything about the ammunition.
What about the ammunition side of the ledger?
Well, that's a very important topic, and you know, California is a state that that has they stamp the ammunition so you can track it better. And there is a lot of talk about, you know, there's a lot of talk about large capacity magazines that can carry a lot of ammunition. So yeah, that's a good point. I mean, ammunition should be as big a part of the conversation as firearms. Yeah. If we're talking about safety, and there is some conversation around that, but that's true. It's focused more on the guns.
Well, let's leave our conversation there, and I appreciate our guests and their time. Heath Druzin from Boise State Public Radio, Lisa Dunn, research editor from WAMU in Washington, D.C., both from NPR's Guns in America team. Thank you both very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
When we come back, John McEwen, a founding member of the legendary Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, joins us. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. It's Monday, and more importantly, if you're on the mailing list, it's the day you'll receive my newsletter in your inbox. It's not too late to sign up. Go to kcur.org/Kraske. You'll get my thoughts on guests and topics and highlights from the up-to-date team each Monday. Subscribe at kcur.org/Kraske. Tomorrow on the show, Edgerton's Logistic Park brings in thousands of employees each day, but the rapid growth has left the city struggling to keep up. We'll learn more about what's being done to support the basic necessities of the workers. That's Tuesday on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, it's not often that we have a guest on the show twice in about a 6-month span, but we make exceptions when we have a chance to visit again with John McEwen, a founding member of the legendary Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. Yes, it is you, John.
Yeah.
John and his band, the String Wizards, are back in town Thursday evening out at Knuckleheads. John was just a featured interview subject on Ken Burns' well-received documentary on country music. He, of course, was a big part of the seminal album with the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, Will the Circle Be Unbroken? That one featured Earl Scruggs and Doc Watson. He's won a Grammy for producing an album with his lifelong friend Steve Martin. He's the author of The Life I've Picked, A Banjo Player's Nitty Gritty Journey. And here he is playing from his latest album, Made in Brooklyn. This is Excitable Boy.
Excitable boy, they all said. Oh, he's just an excitable boy. He took in the 4 a.m. show at the Clark. Excitable boy, they all said. And he bit the usher, rat's leg in the dark. Excitable boy, they all said.
John McEwen joins us from the studios of KUER out in Salt Lake City. John, what a pleasure to have you back again. Welcome.
Oh, it's great to be here. I can't wait to get to Knuckleheads. Frank's always good to play for.
Frank's a great guy to play for. And I was going to say, I know you've had a lot of accolades in your career, John, but 2 appearances on Up to Date in 6 months has got to rank right up there.
It is. It was at the top of my wish list.
There you go. There you go. You just received a heavy dose of national acclaim as one of Ken Burns' commentators on his country music documentary series. You know, the series got very strong reviews. What did you think of it?
I thought it was wonderful. It was exhausting. It was the 2 hours went by like 45 minutes
yes, it
or
did.
Something.
I agree with that.
And when it was over, I felt like I'd been to a lecture class on a subject that I really liked and learned a lot about it. And every now and then I'd pop up, so that was pretty cool.
Well, if you learned a lot about it, you can imagine how much the rest of us learned. Hey, how were you approached to take part in it?
4 years ago, Dayton Duncan.
Four years ago, wow.
Yeah, called me and told me what they were doing. And I said, sure, I'll be on board. And about 3 years ago, I did the interviews. And not knowing, and they didn't know either, because they shot over 700 hours of stuff to pare it down and try and get the story of country music out there. And it was just a wonderful thing. And I ended up in these three or four segments, especially segment six, which is called Will the Circle Be Unbroken?
Yes, right.
And the last picture in the whole segment was me and Earl Scruggs.
Yes. Hey, how much time did you spend in front of the camera talking about all this stuff, and how much did they wind up using? Because I'm just guessing a whole lot got left on the cutting room floor.
I did about 2 hours, and they ended up using, I don't know, 20 minutes of that, you know?
Yeah.
There was just a lot to cover. And sometimes somebody else might have covered something that I did, and they would go to that. And it was pretty much like that. And nobody else was around. You know, I did. Mm-hmm. They did them one at a time. And 20 of the people that they've interviewed have passed away by now.
Wow. I was going to say, was there original interest in you in the recording session for the Dirt Band's Will the Circle Be Unbroken? Is that what brought them to you?
That was a good part of it. And it was also a way to get the Dirt Band in there. And the way it came around, though, with the album is at one point in time, Earl Scruggs had come to see us, thanks to Gary Scruggs, his son, saying, Dad, let's not go to the Opry tonight. Let's go see the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. They're playing at Vanderbilt. Huh. And he came and brought the whole family, and I met the Scruggs family. And Earl said, I just wanted to meet the boy that played Randy Lynn Rag the way I intended to.
No kidding.
And that was one of his hot songs, and that's never left my memory.
I was going to say that must have been just a moment for you, right? Coming from Earl Scruggs, yeah.
Huge moment. And I've got video of that actual meeting in 1971, and I'll post that so people that are interested in that kind of thing can see it. It's sitting in front of Earl and picking with his boys backstage at Vanderbilt.
I watched some of that, getting ready for this. Yeah, that's really, really amazing.
My brother shot it on, he produced the album, Bill did. And 6 months later, I asked Earl Scruggs if he'd record with the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. And he'd said, I'd be proud to. And
wow.
And a week later, Doc Watson was playing in the same club in Colorado. And I'd already met Merle, his son, a few months earlier and told him about my plan to see if Earl would record with us. And I ran up to Merle and said, hey, Merle, Earl said yes. And he got all excited and said, oh, let me introduce you to Daddy now. And wow. Yeah, he said the folk music thing's been dying out for us and the crowds are getting smaller. And I was always proud of the fact that Doc's versions of songs were the most requested, especially Tennessee Stud.
Yeah, yeah.
And that album ended up having Roy Acuff, Maybelle Carter,
yes.
Doc, Merle Travis, he was called on, my brother contacted him, and Jimmy Martin, and Basser Clements, and Junior Husky, and Bashful Brother Oswald. It turned into the dark side of the moon of country music.
Yeah.
And you know something weird? It is now number one on Amazon, and the record company was not ready. I tried to tell them for 6 months, get ready. They've run out of stock.
Will the Circle Be Unbroken you're talking about?
Yes, sir. The Will the Circle Be Unbroken album is number one without having product. People are just ordering it for downloads and stuff. And it's still keeping it at number one on Amazon.
It just holds up so well. Let's play a little bit from, again, the seminal album, Will the Circle Be Unbroken. This is Nashville Blues, and
I
love it.
Oh, man, this is the first time I got to pick with Earl and play a second banjo part, and I was 24 years old.
Let's listen.
Thank you.
You know, John, that music sounds as good today as the day you recorded it. I mean, it's just amazing the timeless value of Will the Circle Be Unbroken.
Thank you. It also, it sounds good because it was recorded two-track live. We had a 16-track machine set up for the first song along with the two-track, which was going to be maybe an experiment.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no reason to run multi-track on this, and so we recorded directly to the master. And,
wow.
34 songs were done in 5 days, and they were done. They didn't have to be mixed, overdubbed to, fixed, or anything. And you most know, of the songs were first take.
That's amazing. You know, going back to the Ken Burns documentary series, did you say something to him that you wish they had used that didn't get used?
Gee, I haven't thought about that.
Were you like, they didn't say that part about the thing, you know?
I think they missed out on Doc Watson. I mentioned him.
Right.
He was an important guy that was the blind guitar player.
Sure.
I'm playing the Appalachian Performing Arts Center. It's reopening October 14th and doing a special Doc Watson tribute. Hmm. And so that was kind of a sad thing. And they didn't mention Linda Ronstadt.
Huh.
And Linda, although she was pop music, country was in her heart, and she did that for so many years. And Linda's a sweet lady. She was never a star, you know, and I've known her since Stone Pony days. Mm-hmm. In fact, she made a nice liner comment on the back of my book.
Hmm.
And
you know, one performer who got a lot of love in country music was Dolly Parton, you know, and for obviously good reasons. You've worked with her. What do you know about her that we don't know?
Well, everybody knows that she says, it costs a lot of money to look this cheap.
She said that a bunch, hadn't she? Yeah.
What do I know about her that you don't know? That's interesting. That she really does have her own way of doing things, and she will see that it gets done her way.
Is that right?
But it's always a good way. She'll do what she wants. One of the times I was out as a solo act for her, I did about 40 shows, and one of the shows, she was going to sing Happy Birthday to my son, Aaron. He was 8 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Dolly, the crowd was really rough tonight. I'd usually get an encore, which was really fun. But this night in Fort Worth, Texas, was just rough, you know, because the people announced, the guy goes out to do the announcement. Hey, everybody, welcome to the Dolly Parton Show. Hooray, hooray, hooray. We're really going to have fun tonight at the Dolly Parton Show. Hooray. And before we start, beer is half price.
Oh.
And here's the opening act, John McKeown. And it's like,
oh, there you go.
I go, what? Am I on?
Yes.
I get up, and half the audience is going to the back of the room to get the beer. And anyway, Dolly ended up dropping I Will Always Love You and Coat of Many Colors from her set because they were a rough audience. But I told her, you don't have to sing Happy Birthday. She goes, John McKeown, you don't know Dolly Parton too well, do you? I'll tell you what, I told Aaron I'm going to sing Happy Birthday to her, and I'm going to do that. And if they don't like it, this audience doesn't like it, they can just take this dress of mine and shove it up their beep.
Yeah. You know, you've also worked with Johnny Cash and June Carter. You were very fond of Johnny Cash. What kind
Both
of experience
of
did you have with the two of them?
Well, Johnny would always say to me, you want to come out and pick on the Carter Family songs with me and June? You know, like he's asking. Are you kidding?
Yes.
Of course I do. But I'd say, yes, sir, that sounds like a good idea. And one
Did you call him sir?
I'd call them JR or Johnny, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And but in that case, I'd call them sir. And one time in Wales, we were out, there's about 2,000 people in the audience, and he was doing two shows, and the Dirt Band wasn't working that night. It was a big country festival that had 12 acts on it that was going across Europe. But he needed to play. And so he took a solo date in Wales. And the first show, he invited me out. We got a special guest coming out here to pick with us, and you might know him, and blah, 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 John McKeown. And the people kind of clapped.
Right. Yeah.
The second show, he says, I think I could do better. So when that comes around, you might have to wait a little longer. And I'm out there in the wings waiting, and he's talking. We're gonna do some, you know, Roy Clark, Chet Atkins, and he's naming all these people, and a nitty gritty dirt band. And he goes on, and so his voice got to where I could hear him from the wings, and he said, and I could hear him say it. And so he's here. He's been describing me, using all those names, you know. And I'm finally getting a very special friend of ours. June and I just love this guy. Show him that you love him, too. He's just here just to meet you people and click with us. Let's make him welcome. 2,000 people that had never heard of me stood up.
Wow. Wow. There you go.
And after the show, he walked up to me and punched me in the arm and said, I told you I could do better.
It's all in the introduction, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He wanted to move those people.
Yeah. What's your sense as you look back on the span of country music? What's the big contribution that country music has wound up making to this country?
It's shown America, if when they listen to the real stuff, that we have come through so many things that America has been great for a long time, and it really continues to be. That's that's one way of putting it, I guess. But it shows you how powerful some of that music is.
Yes.
My daughter cried when Marty Robbins died, and she was only 17. And she was into Pink Floyd. She also cried when Roger Waters left the band. I'll never see him again. You know.
Yeah.
And it shows that the fabric, because the people described in Ken Burns' show, they did things that some of the younger people just couldn't fathom. Mm-hmm. You couldn't, you know, live in construction pipes for 6 months while you're in between gigs. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a little rough.
Right.
A bunch of people traveling around in a car for 3 months, going out and playing dance halls, and just Loretta Lynn's story. She had 4 kids.
Yes.
She was 21, and she decides to be a country singer.
Yes, I didn't know any of that. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Just stuff that is just an amazing thing. It's the desire, the passion that these people had to get their viewpoint out there, their songs, their words, their story.
Yeah.
To get, you know, A.P. Carter and Sarah went with Maybelle to Bristol, Tennessee in 1927, right? Mm-hmm. Well, they went from Hilton's, Virginia. Now, John Carter Cash has become a friend over the years. And in fact, you want to know something funny? He called me last year and said, my dad has some poems that he hasn't finished, and I want you to finish them and turn them into songs.
Wow. Wow.
And I finished 2 of them, and he says, you're a co-writer now with Johnny Cash. I can't believe that.
Wow. But wow.
He said one time, why don't you stay at Maybelle's house, you and your wife? And we stayed at Maybelle's house in Virginia for 3 nights, the same house that she drove to Bristol, Tennessee from. Hmm. And Rita Forrester, the granddaughter, said, the only thing AP wanted to do was get enough money to buy some restaurant plates. Plates, you know, in the restaurant, they don't break. They're heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And she had them. They were right there, a stack of restaurant plates.
There you go.
And he was out, you know, they had very simple desires. And he started making more money than he ever thought he would. And he bought restaurant plates. And a week later, she sent me one of them. I've got A.P. Carter's restaurant plate.
You got one.
It's right next to a Grammy.
That's your point. Why not? John McEwen will be performing at Knuckleheads at 8 Thursday evening with the String Wizards. Tickets go to knuckleheadskc.com. You know, John, can I ask, do you still play as fast as you used to?
As fast?
Yes.
You know, I play more intelligently, I think. I play with
better
taste.
That's a way to put it.
And that's an excuse to say, no, I don't play as fast. But ripping is a good thing. And one of the things we're going to do that I just want people to come to this show. It's the best thing I've done on stage in 20 years.
Hmm.
And the guys that are playing with me, original Nitty Gritty Dirt Band bass player, Les Thompson, and a guy that was in the band in the 70s when we became the first group, American group, to go to Russia for 28 sold-out shows.
Right, right.
And Matt Kartsonis, who's so good, I don't let him sing for at least 6 songs because it's too hard to follow. And we just have a good time. And it's not just a bunch of songs, and it's not the songbook. And it's a bunch of Dan Smith is going to sit in. He's Kansas City's own from the group River Rock. I met him in 73 when I sat in with his band.
Right.
And Kansas City's been so important to me that I have to uphold. I have to live up to that legacy of, yeah. you know, from the Village Vanguard to Cowtown Ballroom. Oh, mm-hmm. my God. Mm-hmm. Well, I bring all that excitement and try to bring it in to the stage again.
Yeah. Well, let's play a little more from John McEwen's latest album. I want to plug it a little bit more. This is Made in Brooklyn. That's the name of the album. This track, Blue Ridge Cabin Home, and I like it.
Oh, good.
Is anybody recording songs like this today, John, like the Dirt Band used to?
Not like the Dirt Band used to, but I like to try the whole Brooklyn. Too many, one question leading me to five answers, my
yeah.
God.
I got 30 seconds. Yeah.
One of the reasons I made that album was to grab a bunch of music the band has overlooked for years. Mm-hmm. And from Bernie Ledden's She Dark the Sun, he was later in the Eagles. He and I played together for 4 months. But there's people in the bluegrass world that do. That album was all done with one microphone.
No kidding. No kidding. And that's the way to do it, right?
It worked for me. The album won the Americana Award at the Independent Music Awards Association.
Well, I should point out that John will be performing again 8 o'clock Thursday evening with the String Wizards out at Knuckleheads. Tickets, knuckleheadskc.com. John, it's always a pleasure to have you here. You can come back anytime you want, okay?
I'll see you in a few days.
Sounds good. Let's go out with the title track from the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band's huge hit album from the 70s, Will the Circle Be Unbroken? Tomorrow on the show, we'll learn how the city of Edgerton, Kansas, is responding to its increased worker population. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date. Stand.